The elimination of all evil.
The scriptural basis for our subject is Revelation 19. It's verses 11 through 21. Now in verse 20 and 21, we're told the manner in which all evil is going to end. It says, "And the beast was taken, and with him the false prophet that wrought miracles before him, with which he deceived them that had received the mark of the beast, and them that worshipped his image. These both were cast alive into the lake of fire, burning with brimstone, and the remnant were slain with the sword of him that sat upon the horse, which sword proceeded out of his mouth, and all the fowl were filled with their flesh." Now we'd also like to read Revelation 18:21, because it also describes the same event. It says, "And a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and cast it into the sea, saying, Thus with violence shall that great city Babylon be thrown down and shall be found no more at all." Now in both these chapters, in both these chapters here in Revelation, we're told just how that enormous, overpowering system that's known as Christendom is to be eliminated. Now, in about 800 B.C., God spoke through his first prophet. The prophet's name was Joel. And then, for the next 500 years, God continued to speak through a prophet. He spoke through someone that he selected. And through each one of those prophets, God let it be known just exactly how disappointed he was with humanity. You know, he's writing history in advance, even before it takes place. So he speaks of his disappointment. Because, you know, man in falling down the broad road to destruction, he didn't have to do such a good job of it. You know, he didn't have to fall so hard. And not only that, what didn't have to take place was papacy. There didn't have to be an Antichrist system so devastating that it would make nighttime or it would make darkness on earth. It would make it so intense that for 1,000 years, historians would refer to this period of time as the Dark Ages. Well, before that happened, before the Dark Ages set in, God prophesied that it would happen. And not only did God prophesy of it, God told how he felt about it. And so as early as 800 B.C., God started to talk about this disaster. He told of his disappointment because, as we said, it wasn't compulsive that papacy should reign and dominate the world in order to teach the lesson of sin. So in the days of Noah's grandchildren, Babylon started, or it first took place. Nimrod was the instigator. He set the example of a mighty hunter. And then he regimented society and he set up idol worshiping on a massive scale. Society quickly changed into leaders and followers, and it just continued to get worse for century after century. Now God permitted this enemy to develop. God chose not to destroy it. He didn't nip it in the bud. Rather, he allowed it to happen. It eventually developed into the universal kingdom of Babylon, whose capital site was on the river Euphrates. Now, this world power that even captured Jerusalem, which is to say Israel itself, this universal power, it was just a picture of a kingdom that the risen Lord told the Apostle John on the Isle of Patmos that it would rise up out of the sea in about the 6th century. The risen Lord also told John that he would be the one that would take charge of the process that would eliminate this final form of Babylon. Now, the way the risen Lord told John the process would be initiated, well, that's told to us in Revelation, the 11th chapter, verse 15, when it says, "And the seventh angel sounded, And there were great voices in heaven saying, the kingdom of this world is become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. Now when the seventh trump sounded, or when the Lord's second presence began, or in the year 1874, the kingdom, or the world itself, became the risen Lord's kingdom. Well, what did and does the risen Lord, the returned Lord, do with this kingdom? God himself, through his prophet, one that he selected, he tells us what he does in Daniel 2:44 when it says, and in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom, which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all of these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Now the moment the Lord returned, or began his second presence, and he interposed in world affairs, that started a war. The old order has got to be destroyed. The new order has got to be established. Now, what's very seldom taken into account about this war is the fact, the manner in which the war is fought. It's fought in a series of battles, battle after battle, until the last battle is fought. And when the struggle is over with, and everyone's going to be able to look back and review what actually took place during this whole period of time, well, only then will the superiorness of divine wisdom be realized. It will show just how it will show the all-encompassing strategy of the Lord, just how it all functioned and has worked together for good. It's also going to show how flawless divine justice is. Now, when everyone realizes these two points, why, they at the same time, they're also going to realize that the Lord, besides being just, he's righteous. Additionally, he's merciful. He's loving. So as we say, from the moment the risen Lord took possession of the world, a war began. The war is made up of several battles. Each battle takes place in order to tear down the present order, or to do as Revelation 2:25 says, and he shall rule them with a rod of iron, as the vessels of a potter shall they be broken to shivers, even as I received of my Father. Well, what really happens each time a battle takes place is, man is endeavoring to make adjustments to his social order, his own social order. Now, for whatever reasons he makes adjustments, it doesn't seem to accomplish what he once accomplished. It just seems like history just keeps repeating itself. And so man tries and tries again. Well, what we quite often say is happening is, man is haphazardly trying to pull himself up by his own bootstraps. And when he gets all tired out trying to save his own social order, well, then God's going to take over. Well, this is partially correct. Man does have to first try to save himself. And also, when he reaches the end of his rope, he's going to ask God to straighten the situation out. Now, what's most critical to also keep in mind about this battle after battle war is, the risen Lord is the general of Jehovah in this warfare. Now, what the risen Lord is doing as the general of Jehovah is, he is directing and controlling the affairs of mankind so that they actually use all of the good things of the kingdom, the future kingdom. They actually use everything increased knowledge produces. You know, they are actually able to use all the chemistry of the earth. They are even using the physics of the universe. The general of Jehovah is letting mankind use everything that he himself will use when the mediatorial reign takes place. Now, mankind is using all of this incorrectly. Now, this is what has been taking place in every battle as the conflict goes on ever since 1874. No one absolutely no one in the kingdom is going to say, you know, if we only had the same tools, the same chemistry, the same physics that the King of Kings is now using, well, then we could have done likewise. Well, they won't be able to say this because they will have had equal opportunity. Man's greatest problem is, while he is able to use everything that is good, everything that's worthwhile, he takes the elements of the earth as an example, and he just fabricates tons and tons of toxic waste. You know, he upsets the ecology of the earth, and he pollutes the air with his nitric and sulfuric emissions. It's man's selfishness. It's his greed, his avariciousness that is causing his self-destruction, and man is going to be brought low. He is going to be humbled, and that will be the turning point after which he will start his walk up the highway of holiness. Now, in the book of Revelation, the risen Lord tells us the course he follows in order to bring man around to this point wherein he can start his walk up that highway. And that course is laid out for us in the 16th chapter. It is the pouring out of the seven vials upon the earth that gains this objective. And when that seventh vial is poured out, well, then you have the condition that is described as a mighty earthquake. And it is so great that Daniel, in describing it, says, "There shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation." And that trouble, we are told, is the death knell for Babylon. In the strictest sense of the word, it is the destruction of Babylon itself that includes the failure of all nations in the world. Now, as we said, the risen Lord told John ahead of time, Babylon would rise up out of the sea. And from that small beginning, the system would grow. It became so great, it became so powerful, that it was given, or the beast was permitted to have power over all kindred, tongues, and nations. The beast is also termed a woman, a queen. The system was considered to be God's house, or considered to be God's temple. The reality, of course, was the only thing that the woman did as the house of God was to make all the world, all the earth, drunk with her wine. And so therefore we're told that the nations are mad. Now this papacy, which made war with the saints and overcame them, this system that made all nations mad, this system is going to be destroyed in God's own due time by the returned Lord as the general of Jehovah. Now there are other missions that the returned Lord is also accomplishing during the period of his return. You know, one of these is Revelation 3, verses 15 and 16, when it says, "I know thy works, that thou art neither cold nor hot. I would that thou were cold or hot. And so then, because thou art lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I'm going to spew thee out of my mouth." Now, the risen Lord, in 1874, returned for the purpose of setting up his kingdom. But before that could happen, the glorified Lord's own bride class, the group that would work together with the risen Lord in destroying papacy, this group had to be made complete and be joined together with their Lord. Well, what this means is they have to be harvested. Now, before that could happen, they had to first leave the church system, the temple group, that the master spews out of his mouth. And so we have the condition of Revelation 18:14, when it says, "And I heard another voice from heaven saying, Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues." Well, after After 1799, papacy had her teeth removed. She was defamed. I wouldn't exactly call her a house pet at that point, but she didn't have her power anymore. Even though everyone is still, they're still afraid of her. Well, the reason they're still afraid is the fact that they're still drunk. But nevertheless, Babylon was fallen after 1799. She received a body blow, and she no longer made war with the saints. Now, the Lord of the harvest told his saints, when he returned, to come out of her, and then he would serve them meat in due season. The returned Lord also said that he personally would enter in, and he would sup with them, and they with him. Now, what's most critical to keep in mind about the rather massive exodus that took place under the divine guidance of the Lord of the harvest is the fact that every individual that came out of a nominal denomination, they didn't come out of one denomination just to go into another denomination. You know, what took place the moment after the risen Lord returned for the purpose of calling his saints out of Babylon is the Lord of the harvest gave a general or a broad call to leave Christendom. Now, the Lord directed each one that responded to the call, the Lord directed them, as we say, not to enter into another denomination, but rather he directed them to the location where he could sit down and sup with them. The Lord of the harvest directed each individual to the environment that corresponds to where all the embryo new creatures that existed in the days of the apostles, or as we say, in the days of the early church, it's where they dwelt. And this location was in an ecclesia. An ecclesia that functions properly. Ecclesia that is a correct assembly is a segment, it's a literal segment of the literal body of Christ that's going to exist for all eternity on the other side of the veil. So after being drawn to this location here on earth, it enables each one then to be spirit begotten. And then as stewards of God, each one is able to use their one lifespan up, to use it up in copying Jesus and doing God's will. Now during the harvest, it is the will of God that the seeds sown for the stars of heaven segment of the Abrahamic covenant, it is God's will that this segment should be brought to term, or this whole group should be brought to term. Now the master himself has over and over again referred to the period of time after 1874 as a harvest time. In the harvest, the wheat will be taken to the barn, and the tares would be brought up into bundles and burned, or they'd be bound up into bundles and they would be burned. Now, just to accomplish both of these facets of the risen Lord's return, it required a totally different function by all the called out spirit begotten new creatures. It required a different function from what all took place during the age itself. What was required was an individual commitment to be united with all other footstep followers in a work. They were united in a work that not only would finalize the gathering of the last grains of wheat, but it would also serve the purpose of holding very high the standard or the banner of God's truth, the banner of God's doctrines. Now this standard, this banner of God's doctrines is what the Lord of the harvest is using in his judgments against Christendom and all nations. The banner of God's doctrines exposes the error, the sin, the selfishness in the present evil world. The Lord of the harvest requires each one that is separated from Babylon, the Lord requires they be personally dedicated to individually and collectively do this work, to do witnessing work, to do public witnessing work that's necessary to distinguish the truth from error. Now, this public witnessing work is to continue in the harvest period, you know, not until we feel that, well, we're just getting a little too old now to be doing that. But rather, this work is to continue until that last saint passes beyond the veil, or until the night comes where no man can work. Now, there just might be a difference of opinion by some in the household today relative to the importance of being a part of this united effort. Or at least there can be a question of just exactly how much personal energy should be expended in public witnessing. In fact, some question the value of any effort at all being expended by any of us. After all, they say, no one even knows you're alive, let alone to pay any attention to what you're saying. We're told by some that the effect that the small chirp that you and those like you are making in this world of over 6 billions of people, well, it's something like throwing a cup of water out into the ocean and then expecting it to change the water level of that body of water. Well, our answer to all of these different forms of scoffing is just keep in mind that no one could ever be more alone and reduced to a mere whisper than Jeremiah was. And yet he publicly held up the banner. Now, what makes all efforts put forth here on earth to bear witness to the truth, whether it is Jeremiah's efforts or it's our efforts, what makes all of these efforts worthwhile is the fact that God in his divine providence is blessing these efforts. He is coordinating these efforts to serve his eternal purposes. And thus, the witness God wanted to be given during the complete harvest time, it's been given. But you want to know something? We all know it. This same witness is still being given, the very same one. And this witness is going to continue to be given until that last vial is poured out into the air, which could very well be a public witness message over the airwaves, maybe. This message that is continually given by the called out ones during the harvest, this message is an exposure of sin and evil. It exposes Satan as the father of all lies. This message also includes the reality that all evil is to be eliminated. Now, as we said, Revelation 19, verses 11 through 21, shows the Lord of the harvest riding on to eliminate all evil. To destroy evil, one must completely destroy its source. That's Lucifer, isn't it? That's that old serpent, the devil. For when the risen Lord returned in 1874, he returned to a condition of wickedness running rampant. Now, as we said, the Lord's return marked the beginning of a harvest. He was the Lord of the harvest. And one of the segments of the harvest work has been Psalms 50, verse 5, when it says, "Gather my saints together unto me, those that have made a covenant with me by sacrifice." Now, another segment of the same harvest, of the same harvest work, it's been Zephaniah 3:8, when it says, "Therefore wait ye upon me, said the Lord, until the day that I rise up to the prey. For my determination is to gather the nations, that I may assemble the kingdoms, to pour upon them mine indignation, even all my fierce anger. For all the earth shall be devoured with the fire of my jealousy." The risen Lord, as the general of Jehovah, is doing all this work. This work was prophesied by God himself from about 800 B.C. to about 300 B.C. Then after Malachi, God stopped talking. He was stone silent. But then God's Son took over. And especially in the book of Revelation, the risen Lord tells how all evil will be eliminated. Now, if man wants to destroy something, what he does is he takes a bomb and he drops it on it. They call it precision bombing now. And if that doesn't work, they'll drop two bombs. And if it's serious enough, they'll drop a hydrogen bomb. But God doesn't work that way. When God's general destroys or eliminates all evil, the sinner will not be destroyed. Only the sin itself will be destroyed. You know, even Satan is going to be put into a pit for 1,000 years. Of course, he will get destroyed after 1,000 years, along with anyone else that is incorrigible. But during the time of the Lord's second presence, the sinner doesn't get destroyed. In fact, during this period of time, he's learning lessons. All of them are learning lessons that will benefit them for all eternity. Man, in his frantic effort to govern himself and save himself from destruction, well, he's going to fail so thoroughly that the memory of this failure and the memory of his conduct and the things that he did, it's going to be an everlasting lesson for all creatures, great and small. You know, right today, mankind is in his darkest hour. We keep hearing, we even hear brethren talk more and more about Armageddon, Jacob's trouble. Now, before that grand and awful time that God fights for Israel as he did in days of old, you know, before the bow of God is smitten and all of their arrows fall out of the right hand, before Ezekiel 38:20 takes place, when it says, so that the fishes of the sea and the fowl of the heaven and the beasts of the field and all creeping things that creepeth upon the earth and all the men that are upon the face of the earth shall shake at my presence, and the mountains shall be thrown down, and the steep places shall fall, and every wall shall fall to the ground. Now, before this happens, Revelation 18:21 has to happen, when it says, and a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone, and he cast it into the sea, saying, thus with violence shall that great city Babylon be thrown down, and shall be found no more at all. Well, the one thing we are not trying to do is, we're not trying to give any assurances like, well, don't worry, things are not going, there's not going to be changes taking place yet. Really not for a long time. We're not saying everything that is important, that this is all still future. This is all ahead of us. We haven't really seen anything yet. But this would be wrong to say that. Even as Apostle Peter says in 2 Peter 3:4, when he says, and saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of the creation. Well, all things are not continuing as they were from the beginning of creation. Things are changing, as we know. We talk about it continually. They're changing fast. Now, what could very well take place any moment from this day forward is Isaiah 47, verses 8, 9, and 11, when it says, therefore now hear this, thou that art given to pleasure, that dwellest carelessly, that sayest in thine heart, I am and none else besides me. I shall not sit as a widow, neither shall I know the loss of children. But these two things shall come to thee in a moment, in one day. The loss of children and widowhood, they shall come upon thee in their perfection, for the multitude of thy sorceries and for the great abundance of thine enchantments. Therefore shall evil come upon thee, thou shalt not know from whence it rises. Mischief shall fall upon thee, thou shalt not be able to put it off, and desolation shall come upon thee suddenly, thou shalt not know. Well, this tells us, what it's telling us is, it's telling us just exactly how quick what we have read in Revelation 18, verses 19 through 21 can happen. How quick it can take place. You know, once that stone gets lifted up into the air, the dropping of it, it doesn't take very long. You know, just how long did it take to knock that Berlin Wall down? There was a time most everyone thought that was going to last for 100 years. Well, now, we also feel it's very important to tie in the feature of the vine of the earth being harvested. The vine of the earth, the product that Satan controls, it's going to be cut down. It's going to be cast into this great winepress of God. It is the Lord of the harvest that treads this winepress, even as it's stated in Isaiah 63:3. Now the significance of the master trotting this winepress alone, as we're told, both in Revelation and by the prophet Isaiah, the significance of our being told this is to show that it is the master and not man that is personally in control. The master is coordinating everything that takes place in order to have the destruction of sin and at the same time have the redemption of the sinner. Now, most likely, as the great millstone is cast into the sea, after that, the merchants who personally profited from Christendom, well, at this point, they'll probably lament. Now, how long they're going to lament, I don't know, because the angel with the sharp sickle, he thrusts his sickle into the grapes of earth, and you have, as we read, Ezekiel 38:20, wherein you have all men upon the face of the earth shaking. Now, there is a point in time wherein all of these descriptions of trouble, they come together. And there's going to be the final battle. There will be the final lesson in alienationship from God. And then the words of the man with the writer's inkhorn, as it's recorded for us in Ezekiel, the 10th chapter, will be uttered. It is finished. At that point, man will finally have the 46th Psalm, verse 9, when it says, "He maketh wars to cease unto the end of the earth. He breaketh the bow and cutteth the spear in sunder. He burneth the chariot in the fires." Wars, trouble will cease. Divine providence does this. The only way it can take place. Providence is so kind and so loving. Well, in all of these activities that the Lord of the harvest has been engaged in, and all these activities that the Lord of the harvest continues to be engaged in, there is one gem that we feel it seems to stand out above everything else. And we haven't even given a hint about that yet. But this gem is also a product of the harvest. Or at least it literally can be seen and identified because it was harvested by the Lord of the harvest. And what we're referring to is Revelation the 14th chapter, verses 4 and 5, when it says, these are they which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are they which follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. These were redeemed from amongst men, being the first fruits unto God to the Lamb. And in their mouth was found no guile, for they are without fault before the throne of God. Well, there it is. You know, if you want a description of just exactly who the called, the chosen, and the faithful are, well, this is the description. What's described here is the unadulterated little flock, the 144,000. I'm sure that each one of us have our own special way of being thrilled each time we read these two verses and explain these two verses. You know, for me, I say to myself that right now there are 6 billions of people in the world, and there has always been hundreds of thousands of peoples here on earth ever since the day of Pentecost, and yet only 144,000 properly follow the Lamb. To follow the Lamb properly means, it means correctly knowing the Master. It means truly, accurately knowing Him, and then doing what He says. Now, I personally have been praying to properly know the Master for over 50 years now, and I'm still praying. I must know Him as completely as possible before I can fully and properly follow Him. It is the intensity of knowing Him. And this intensity must increase and increase, even though each one of us has constantly been a follower. Now, to be without guile, you know, not to have no guile, it's not as simple as it sounds. Now, having guile, being deceitful, this is something that all of Adam's children are inclined to do. It's next to the rule of the survival of the fittest. And we've heard the expression, a little guile is in everyone. Well, having guile, it also means being cunning. Now, most everyone feels, are inclined to be of the disposition of considering, well, they consider it a compliment to be considered that they're guile, to be considered that they are cunning. And the same is true with being crafty. You know, most everyone kind of has a smile of contentment on their face if someone else is of the opinion that they're a crafty individual. Well, one thing is absolutely positive. The Master wasn't crafty. The Master wasn't cunning. Nor was there any treachery in Him. And we'd like to ask the question at this point, just how many of us can say in our own hearts, the same is completely true of me at the present time? Well, the harvest itself is going to end. And when that harvest ends, so will evil end. And after evil ends, what's going to be brought into existence is going to be the bride of Christ. It'll be the virgin class that has no guile. It will be in full vision, even though it'll be invisible. And then after that, when the kingdom work is going to be over, there won't even be any guile found anywhere here on earth. Nothing deceitful, nothing cunning, nothing crafty, no treachery is going to be found anywhere in the universe. May the Lord add His blessing.